This is the State of Things broadcasting from the American Tobacco Historic District. I'm Anita Rao. Hip-hop has long been a part of life for Kaisha Jennings. Growing up in Queens, New York, she worked her way through high school at a popular local sneaker store and got to meet all sorts of famous artists. This wasn't the first time she brushed up against hip-hop celebrities. Her father ran in the same circles as a 13-time Grammy-nominated rapper Nas and was even featured in one of his music videos. Kaisha's relationship to hip-hop culture was complicated during her childhood. Her reflections on her experiences eventually led her to her current career, researching the rhetoric and linguistics of hip-hop. Kaisha Jennings is currently an English lecturer and faculty mentor at North Carolina State University, where she teaches first-year writing. She's also a regular columnist at Indie Week and a PhD candidate at the Indiana University of Pennsylvania. Kaisha, welcome back to The State of Things.
Hi, Anita.
I'm so happy to talk to you. So much I want to ask you about today, including WAP, but we're gonna start with your own childhood, and we'll get to that later. So talk to me about growing up. I described your relationship with hip-hop as complicated. What made it so complicated for you?
I don't think that my relationship with hip-hop was complicated. I think, if anything, my relationship to I guess my dad would be what was complicated. Hmm. Not my relationship with hip-hop. My relationship with hip-hop is what kind of led me to my career, led me to different opportunities that I didn't know existed, such as like curating a music festival or being able to moderate a panel at one of the top hip-hop conferences in the United States. So I wouldn't say that my relationship to hip hop was complicated, but I would say that the entry, you know, I think on the outside looking in, many people would say that my connection or attachment to hip hop is directly or indirectly influenced by my dad.
Tell me more about your dad then.
Yeah, I think the complication, it comes from somewhat of like the shame of having a father who was incarcerated. And so my father was in and out of prison my entire life. And when I was 12, he was sentenced to 15 years. And he died in prison when I was 26 years old. Mm. And there were like many moments throughout my upbringing where, you know, parts of my life felt like a movie. It felt so unreal. And I just knew that many people would not understand because they haven't experienced what it's like to have a gangster for a parent. Mm-hmm. And I never wanted to like glorify his past or have anyone, you know, feel sorry for me because I had an amazing childhood. I had an amazing childhood and amazing relationship with both my parents, even through, you know, the incarceration. So I guess that's where the complication would come from. You know, like hip hop is like a constant reminder of that relationship with, you know, my father.
So in the period in which your dad was incarcerated, or I guess a lot of your youth, you were mostly raised by your mom, your grandma, and your aunt. Is that right? I'd love for you to kind of describe your home life and the people that raised you.
Yeah, I was raised by my mom, but I grew up in a two-parent household. My mom married when I was 8 years old. She got married. But my childhood consisted of a lot of communal parenting and, you know, the saying, it takes a village to raise a child.
Yeah.
That is what myself and my cousins like experienced, you know? So if my mom had to work at night, we would spend a night at my grandma's house and she would get us ready for school in the morning. Just everybody helping out. It just kind of signifies the importance of family within the Black community. And in just this idea of communal parenting, you know, a lot of times we had to get permission from each adult, even if they weren't, you know, your parent, you still had to get permission to do an activity or something like that. But my childhood was amazing in terms of, you know, we had everything that we could have ever asked for. You know, we didn't have to want for anything. And I think that kind of sheltered us to what the reality of the world in adulthood would be like. But at the same time, I'm forever grateful to have that communal child raising experience.
How did things change for you when your stepdad came into the picture? I know you kind of were always negotiating differences among the class dynamics between your cousins on your dad's side and your environment with your mom. And then when your stepfather entered the picture, that brought in a whole different dynamic. So take me into that a little bit.
So I always tell people that I have a unique view of life because I feel like I got to experience access to, you know, three different socioeconomic statuses or classes. So my mom's family is pretty middle class. My mom grew up in a two-parent middle class home, whereas my dad, though, his siblings, they grew up in essentially poverty. And even though my mom and dad actually lived within like a five-block radius from each other, their home structure was so different. You know, my dad and his brothers, they were raised by their grandmother and aunt, and there were at any time 12 kids living in a house home with two adults. And they weren't fortunate enough to have a male figure in the home. In a lot of ways, they had to fend for themselves and didn't have that stability that my mom had growing up. And then on the flip side of that, my stepfather's family, they are pretty upper middle class or considered to be wealthy. My grandfather, he was the first Black player at St. John's University. And he also was drafted by the New York Knicks in the 1950s. He never got to play because of a knee injury, but he was able to establish this wonderful career in education. And my grandmommy, she was a nurse for a number of years. And so they established a life of upper middle class slash wealth that benefited me by, like, when it was time for, like, to pay for college or something, or if I needed to take a summer school class, you know, it was a matter of asking grandmommy or letting her know what my educational desires were. And, you know, they were able to help me pay for college.
How did that shape your experience socially, kind of knowing and navigating those varying class dynamics?
I think it kept me grounded and humble. Being able to kind of navigate between all three. And also it gave me the stamina and the tools to pretty much be in any situation, right? So, you know, if you put me in a rich neighborhood, I'm gonna be okay. I'm gonna be good. And if you take me to a hood, I know how to navigate that space too. I'm gonna be good. And also when it comes to like spending money, you know, I know how to shop a good sale. I know how to use coupons, but I also enjoy being able to splurge a little bit. So I feel like, you know, it kept me well-rounded and grounded. And also the most important thing is I'm always thinking about how I can help, right? How I can give back. And even if it's just a little bit. But yeah, those three experiences have taught me to respect all people, regardless of their job title, socioeconomic status. That none of that matters. What matters is the person's character.
How, as a kid, because I know, I mean, at least for me, like it's you kind of know about people's socioeconomic status through these markers, like maybe what they look like, or you make certain associations based on what their house looks like or the kind of clothes they wear, or the kind of shoes they wear. So as a kid, I mean, did you see people show wealth in different ways? Like, is that how this became obvious to you?
Yeah. The house is number one, you know, whether it was the type of furniture or whether it was what neighborhood the house was located in. And I'm from New York, and New York is a very materialistic place to live in. I remember in high school, you know, when the Jordans would come out every Monday, you knew who was able to afford by who had the newest Jordans on Monday. Even when it came to like cell phones, you know, every time a new phone came out, I would take the public transportation bus back and forth to school. And, you know, it kind of was like, people kind of flaunt in their materialistic items. So, you know, who had the newest Sidekick? New York is very a materialistic culture. So you got to see who had what and who didn't have what.
Did your friends think of you as one particular way or the other based on what you had or didn't have?
I think for the most part, my friends and I were all a part of the same class status. For the most part, yeah, I think we were all a part of the same class status. But I will say that, you know, some of our neighborhoods were considered to be more hood than the others. And I always felt like my mom purchased a house when she was 30, which was like a big, you know, achievement for her to be able to purchase a house for us to live in. But I always say that our house is on the borderline of the hood. If you go one way, you know, it gets a little bit more, but if you go another way, it looks far more residential. And so some of my friends may have lived in a neighborhood that was like not considered to be as hood as my neighborhood. But for the most part, we had similar class statuses.
So I want to talk with you a bit about language. I know that has come to be a big interest of yours and focus of some of your academic work. But as a kid, talk to me about how you kind of noticed the way that you were perceived based on how you spoke. How did that come up for you when you were really young?
I was considered, you know, the ghetto girl, the loud ghetto little black girl. And then as I got to high school and I went to a predominantly Asian and white high school, when I would come back to my neighborhood or even at the sneaker store, then sometimes people would say, oh, you sound white. And I'm like, okay, so which one is it? Am I the loud ghetto girl or do I talk like I'm white? Which doesn't exist, by the way. And so just having people critique your language constantly, you know, regardless of what you say, whether they're critiquing it to say you sound like this or you sound like that, just a constant monitoring and policing of my language. In third grade, my teacher would always say, Kaisha, ain't is not a word.
Well, how did you, I mean, did you notice yourself like code switching and switching based on where you were, or was it more other people were reflecting that back to you?
I think one thing I remember is I noticed people kept trying to correct my language when speaking. You know, in AAVE, in Black English, the to be verb is used differently, right? So I would say something and Monty would be like, that is, you're supposed to be an English major. That is not how you're supposed to say it. So just this constant correcting, you know, of language. And it made me not realize that there was value in Black English or African-American vernacular English, you know.
When did you realize that? When did you begin to realize that there was value there and it wasn't something to be just dismissed offhand?
In graduate school, which is ridiculous. In graduate school. And there's like a light bulb went off, like, wait a minute. You mean to tell me? And I think a number of things allowed me to realize it. Reading the works of scholars who have come before me, seeing them be their authentic selves and talk in their, you know, native language, whether that is regional, whether it is cultural, you know, because using a Southern dialect in one's writing, Regina Bradley, she does a good job at holding on to a Southern dialect. And I love the way she kind of plays around with spelling of words. And she does this in her academic writings and on social media. Todd English, he's another scholar where I remember reading one of his articles and, you know, I felt like I was talking to somebody in my family. And I felt like it wasn't stiff and it wasn't boring. And he also was able to cuss. And I was just like, wow, this is great. Like, I want to be able to blend my own voice. And opposed to like trying to fit into academia, allow academia to have to, you know, modify themselves around my voice.
Yeah. I mean, you started getting on a path to that when you went to college at Lincoln University, but I'd love to kind of just take a half step back for a second and talk about you deciding to go to college. So we have you kind of as this kid growing up, navigating these various spaces in Queens. You work at this sneaker store, and then it was an interaction there that inspired you to decide to go to an HBCU. So tell me that story.
Yeah, so I was working at this popular sneaker store. It was called Moe's Sneaker Spot, and it was really a staple in Queens. The owners, they had two locations. They ended up selling it a couple of years ago, and actually the building that it was in is no longer standing, but it was really like a staple in Queens. And so it was like cool to have a job there. But I remember, you know, enjoying working there. I worked there from the ages of 16 through about like 19 and a half, 20. And I got to meet the sneaker buyers from like Nike and Timberland and stuff. And I remember because I was always an inquisitive kid. Like, I'm going to ask you 1,001 questions, and I still do that today. If I want to know something, I'm going to ask questions. And so I remember talking to the representatives that would come in, and I asked the one girl, I said, can you shop on Fifth Avenue with your job? And, you know, she was like, you mean the Fifth Avenue in Brooklyn? But I was trying to figure out if I could continue a career in that, you know, realm. You know, I knew I didn't want to stay in the sneaker store, but seeing the people who worked for Nike and worked for Timberland and worked for Puma come to the store, I had all these questions for them. And I remember my manager, he was trying to get me to stay, you know, to stay and continue to kind of grow within, you know, that field. But I wanted to leave New York. Like, I wanted to experience New York. And I felt like going to an HBCU was like a rite of passage that I desired to experience. And a group of girls came in my store one day, and they had went to my high school. They were one of the girls, she was actually my cheerleading captain in high school. And they were so excited, and they came in the store with a lot of energy. And I think they were shopping for homecoming or something. But I just remember them telling me, like, you should come to Lincoln. You know, we're on a dance team, and a dance team is number one, and it's a lot of fun, and the parties are good. And, you know, they just sold Lincoln University to me. I had never heard of it. I was the first person in my family to go away to college. So I wasn't the first person in my family to go to college, but I was the first person in my family to go away to college and the first person to go to HBCU. So I didn't really have nobody to guide me on that journey in terms of like how to choose a college. So because, you know, these former seniors from high school, they came in, they mentioned Lincoln. I looked up Lincoln, and I was a dancer. I, you know, did hip hop dance, ballet, jazz, tap. And I saw that their SAT requirement was low. Like, I had a higher SAT. I'm not a really good test taker, but my SAT score was high enough to get into Lincoln. And so I was like, oh, I can go to college.
Yeah.
I think they had asked for like a C average, and I had like a B minus or B plus. And I was like, oh, I can go to college. And I applied to Lincoln. I think Lincoln was one of the only schools I applied to, because their application was only $20. Every other college application was a little bit more. And around that time, my mom was going through a divorce. And, you know, she never said I didn't have it, but she was just like, you know. And so I applied to Lincoln with the $20 application and got a scholarship.
Wow. And
so, of course, once I got that scholarship, she was like, oh, you're going to Lincoln. Don't apply to nowhere else.
What was it like to go and leave? I mean, you were so embedded in your community in so many ways. And, you know, you'd maybe even seen this future for yourself in the sneaker trade. So what was it like to leave Queens? That must have been a big jump.
Oh, it was a culture shock. it was a huge culture shock. But also, it became fascinating because, you know, I went to college with my high school best friend. So we did everything together. Like, my mother took us to the one day drive-in, to the week orientation. And so I wasn't like, you know, by myself. And so, it was a culture shock for us, number one. And then number two, that culture shock then became fascinating because we got to, be introduced to other regional culture, such as like Baltimore club music and Philly's culture, they're you know, vernacular, they're slang. And we would constantly compare the way that, you know, somebody in Philly would say something and the way that we would say something in New York. The way that they dress was different, the music they listened to, the type of dances were different. So this is what, 2006 in New York. In 2006 we were doing the chicken noodle soup, a lot of like Harlem originated dances. And then in Philly, they were still doing a dance called the Wu-Tang. And so it became fascinating to see, you know, all these like different diverse ways of Black culture and engaging with different forms of creativity and music. That was my first time hearing go-go music.
Well, and I mean, Lincoln itself was in rural Pennsylvania, in this predominantly white area.
So middle of nowhere.
So, I mean, what was that like? I know you studied education and you were a student teacher in this high school where there was, what, one black teacher? Everyone else was white. What was it like to be in that space?
So by the time that so my major was originally journalism. I always wanted to be a journalist and write about hip hop. That was always the goal. But I ended up having an intro to journalism class, and I got an F. Now, mind you, I was always a smart kid throughout my childhood. In high school, I, you know, got A's and B's. But I was always a smart kid. I never got an F. And so when I got that F, it scared me. And I even remember my mom didn't tell me that I got an F because the rest of my report card were A's and A minuses. But it scared me. And so I changed my major because I'm like, I can't graduate with F's on my transcript. So I changed my major to education. And I knew that I didn't want to teach high school for long. I was like, okay, I'm going to teach high school for 5 years and I'll become a principal or something like that. Well, my student teaching experience in this predominantly white town wasn't a good one. It was actually my first encounter with racism. And I believe I was 20 years old. And one of the first days of school, you know, I'm just like this little bubbly kid and, again, inquisitive. So I'm asking questions and nobody talked to me. I was so excited to be able to be in a teacher's faculty room, you know. Nobody said good morning. Nobody said hello. Nobody said your classroom is down the hall.
Wow.
They didn't say anything.
Just weren't even acknowledged at all.
No acknowledgement. No acknowledgement. But the kids, though, I remember that when some of the black kids, when they saw me, they act as if they saw a ghost or a celebrity. It was mind-boggling. Like, it was such a unique experience, and that experience let me know that I needed and desired to teach African-American literature. Of course, that experience also let me know that secondary school, you know, it wasn't for me.
Yeah. Well, I mean, I know you started thinking a lot about language at that point. Was there anything interesting about kind of your presence? Did that change how the kids talked to you? Or did you notice anything about kind of comparing, you know, standard English to AAV and how that showed up for the kids in that school?
I don't remember it particularly in that school, but I know since I've been in academia, definitely. I used to teach at a community college in Greensboro. And I guess because when I started teaching college, I was super young. I was like 23 years old. And so the kids, they weren't kids. They were adults. They related to me more. And I remember there was a young white student. She complained to my dean about me speaking to a student, you know, using slang or using, you know, my native tongue. I didn't get in trouble. My dean understood and knew the importance of, you know, culturally relevant, engaging with students. But just to have that student think that she, you know, had the authority to critique the way that I'm speaking to a student outside of class, not in class. And even if it was in class, that would be okay.
It's not slang, right? I mean, maybe you can break that down for people that don't really understand the history of AAVE and kind of that it is its own dialect with particular rules. And we kind of misunderstand it as slang because we kind of appropriate these very particular pieces of AAVE as slang that become common in standard English. But kind of if you could articulate that nuance for us, it is its own dialect.
Absolutely. And there's scholarship that has proven that in, you know, Geneva Smitherman's text, Talking and Testifying, that was published in 1977. You know, so this is not a new phenomenon. It was published in 1977. And there's recent literature, like there's a text by April Baker Bell, Marcelina Morgan. She's an amazing scholar who has done research on language and discourse. And also Elaine Richardson has done amazing work. But I think in that example, I don't remember the conversation, but slang is what the term the student had used.
Yeah.
So
while you were at college, you met a mentor that really shifted things for you, really changed the trajectory of your career. And I'd love for you to tell us about him and what it was about kind of the way that he engaged in scholarship that really struck you.
So after it was myself and another peer at Lincoln where we had that negative student teaching experience. So we had to actually get repositioned or replaced at another school because the first school was like so toxic and it just wasn't a good fit. And so that, you know, left a bad taste in my mouth. And I felt like I didn't want to teach to a test. I didn't want to have to answer to parents. I felt like there was no power, you know, and for secondary teachers. I wanted to teach what I wanted to teach. I didn't want to be policed. And everything I wanted, Dr. Petrow had, you know, he was teaching us what he wanted to teach us, and he taught it in such an engaging manner. He had so much freedom and flexibility in the classroom, and he didn't seem stressed. A lot of times when you interact with public school teachers, because of the way that the field is not valued in terms of, you know, pay and everything like that, they appear to be stressed. And Dr. Petrow, he didn't seem stressed. And this epiphany went off, and I was like, I want to do what he's doing. And we had a conversation, and he shared that he had his PhD in hip hop. And of course he was joking. But that moment, right, the negative experience of student teaching, realizing that I didn't want to be in that situation ever again, and then realizing that I desired the flexibility that one of my favorite professors in college had, and then having this conversation about, oh, you can incorporate hip-hop in your teaching too, it totally changed the trajectory of my career. And remember, because I was at this predominantly white school where they weren't teaching African-American lit, I ended up getting my master's degree in African-American literature because of that experience. I was like, I want to teach Black women writers, Black stories. And I was like, can you help me?
Yeah. And
he did.
And he really showed you that, you know, you could kind of claim parts of your own story and your own culture and bring those into your scholarship. And I actually have a surprise for you, which is that we reached out to him. And here is a little clip of him talking about you and your work. So let's listen to a clip of Emory Petchauer.
One thing I know about Taisha is she's got the work ethic, and she's very wise to spread herself across a few different areas, kind of have a diverse portfolio in some ways. And that's something I think is so wise, and I'm so proud of her for, is though she's an emerging scholar and academician, that's just not the only thing she wants to do. She's also passionate about the cultural work, the cultural writing she does. And I think that's so important because that's going to leave her so many avenues and options opposed to just the really truly narrow academic track. Just as a mentor, I'm happy that that her skill set is so diverse in those ways that she's put in the effort to really hone her craft in so many different domains, because that's just going to allow her to be successful and be of service to such a broad community of people.
So that's Emory Petchauer, an associate professor of English at Michigan State University, talking about his mentee, Keisha Jennings, who is my guest today. So, Keisha, I'm going to let you take a minute and reflect on that.
This is payback. He got me back. He was on a panel a couple of weeks ago, and I got the honor to introduce him.
Oh.
And it was a surprise. And when I introduced him, I was so excited to do it, and I ended up, like, crying.
Oh.
At the end, because, you know, of my gratefulness to his guidance, you know. It's, you know, our mentor-mentee relationship, I always joke and say it's like the rapper and the manager. It happened organically. You know, we never sat down and say, hey, can you be my mentor? It just happened so organically. And I think what happened was, again, me being inquisitive, I just kept asking him questions. I just kept texting him and emailing him and asking him questions. And, you know, I started my PhD program 6 years after my master's program. I needed a break. But within those 6 years, I had Petch, and he was giving me this, you like, unique 101, this is how you survive academia.
So much guidance. I'm going to pause you right there, and we're going to take a quick break, and we will come back and talk a bit more about him and your relationship and everything he inspired in you that you are working on today. So stay with us on The State of Things as I continue talking to Keisha Jennings. This is The State of Things. I'm Anita Rao. Kaisha Jennings is my guest today. She's a scholar and writer taking a critical eye to the rhetoric and linguistics of hip-hop. She's also a regular columnist for the Indie Week and an English lecturer at NC State University. So right before the break, we played a clip from your mentor who really spoke about this mixed methods approach that you have taken and your kind of attempt to bring the academic world and popular culture and hip-hop and kind of less scholarly writing all into your work. So I'd love to know kind of why that's important for you. How did you land on this personal mission of wanting to integrate all of those various worlds in your work?
I don't know if it was intentional. I think it goes back to being inquisitive. One of my professors at IUP, he pointed out to me, he said, Kaisha, you are a reactionary writer. And I think that, you know, he's so right. I also think that I have, like, multiple interests, but they all center around hip-hop and Black culture. I think I've always juggled more than one thing. Like, I've always done that. And I feel like I see myself as like a storyteller or an advocator for folks. And so I find that no matter what I'm doing in whatever capacity, whether it's writing for the Indie, whether it's writing an academic article or teaching a course or curating an event, I find that I am attempting to not only tell stories, but protect and advocate for folks. So advocate for Black women and girls, advocate for Black writers, advocate for visual artists, and also advocate for independent local hip hop artists.
And I also see you kind of advocating for some women in hip hop who represent aspects of your own story. You're interested in Megan Thee Stallion and you've looked at Cardi B. And I see some parallels between kind of the way that they have come up and their backstory and yours. Is that kind of part of what drives you to be interested in them in particular?
Yeah, absolutely. The piece that I'm working on about Cardi, it was an invited chapter for an upcoming book that will be edited by Ruth Nicole Brown and Aisha Durham, two amazing hip-hop feminist scholars. And the motivation for that piece was essentially little black ghetto girls all around the world to just validate their existence, and because that was me.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? And I needed somebody to validate my existence and say, you are okay as you are. You're not less than because of whatever, you know, because you may have higher energy. And it's funny now because the hood aesthetic is so trendy. You know what I mean? Like, everybody wants to put on this, whether from the long nails to the bamboo earrings to the hairstyles, you know, it's cool to kind of wear and or co-opt this hood aesthetic. But
how do you feel about that? Does that rub you the wrong way, or what do you make of that?
You know, it rubs the wrong way when the care for hood girls are actually not there. You know what I mean? So it's important to have the care for actual girls who may be impacted. So for example, you know, Cardi B's language has been appropriated by so many white folks and white publications. You know, they publish a Cardi dictionary and, you know, let's practice the language of Cardi, all this. But in schools, you know, many Cardi B's are being denounced because of the language that they use. But here, being, you know, celebrated and wanting to perform it in a way. And that's what was challenging.
What do you think could be done about that? I mean, as you look into this from a scholarly perspective and you reflect back on your own experience in the classroom, do you think teachers should affirm the way that students talk no matter what, and then, you know, recognize that they will maybe have to code switch at other points in their life based on their career or whatever? Or I don't know. How would you approach that in the classroom?
I think, number one, we should honor the creativity of Black and brown children. Number two, it's important for educators, regardless of their position, whether they're like a facilitator, a coach, a teacher, they should attempt to read up on Black English. Mm-hmm. But again, the scholarship is there. And it doesn't matter if you're white or Black. You know, sometimes Black folks kind of condition and internalize anti-Black ideals too. And also, there's a difference between code switching and code meshing, and capturing the nuance of those differences is what also is important. And at its core, what we're really talking about is context, right? Understanding the context in which we speak in.
How do you code mesh in your life now as you're moving between all these spaces?
Well, now that I have almost 10 years in academia, I think I just make sure to try to show up as myself. And so there was actually a thread in a Facebook group the other day, and the person was upset that the student started the email off without addressing their name, something to that extent. And I was thinking to myself, like, oh, wow. I say to my students, hey, guys, like, I'm like, hey, like, I'm just always so chill and calm. And I just try my best to, I feel like I've been through enough in academia where I can own, like, my language, how I present myself, whether it's changing of my hairstyles or whether it's how I speak. I feel like I feel more confident in owning that. So whether I say hey or what's up or what's good to my students, it's still saying hello.
Exactly.
What I mean?
The same message is being communicated. Well, how about in digital spaces? Because I know that's something you spend a lot of time thinking about Black Twitter and thinking about kind of how various hip hop artists represent themselves digitally. And I'm curious about how you see kind of a definition or a way of articulating someone's feminism that shows up through the use of these spaces.
So what I was kind of trying to hone in on in the Hot Girl Summer piece is looking at, like, the representation of Black women and Black girls in digital spaces and noticing that they are embodying a hip-hop feminist ethos, whether they know it or not. And so I came up with this framework called Digital Hip-Hop Feminist Sensibility. And at its core, the framework is just designed to better understand the performance of Black women and girls on Twitter and Instagram. And what we're noticing is that they are kind of asserting disrespectability politics. Like, they're not interested in following a certain type of respectability politics.
Do you notice that in yourself or in women in your own life?
Absolutely. Absolutely. I am so proud of, like, my mama and my aunts. They are a different breed, okay?
Why is that?
And you know, they're a different breed in such an admirable way. And I'm speaking of, like, most of the women in my life. So, like, my mom, my aunts, my godmom, extended women who, you know, are in my family circle. They are independent. They know what they want and what they do not want. They like to have fun. And most of them are, I think now everybody's like 55 and up or 54 and up, but they like to have fun. And most importantly, they do a good job at balancing respecting themselves, but also not conforming to any politics of respectability. They absolutely do what they want, when they want, and how they want. And so seeing these examples of womanhood and femininity from such a young age, it allowed me to kind of develop this, like, sense of security and sureness in myself. I never had to navigate low self-esteem because I never saw the woman in my life have low self-esteem, you know? And unfortunately, a lot of times women are conditioned to stay in bad marriages or bad relationships, whatever the reason, financial stability, security for the kids, or maybe because they have low self-esteem. And then sometimes other women, they may kind of give up on love altogether after a failed relationship. And I see this in some of my friends, you know, families and or parents, but not the women in my family. You know, they have been divorced and they have found love again. You know what I mean? Like, they have also shown that you can have happiness with or without a partner. And I have just witnessed them put themselves first, put their pleasure first, and then also witnessed them maintain friendships with other women. And that's another part of like Black feminism, like the communal aspect, right? That's important. And so to witness my mom and my aunts and the extended woman in our family, like, be able to maintain and cultivate friendships with other women for 20 plus years, those things are all important when it comes to raising girls.
Yeah. And I mean, I think the pleasure part of it is really important to highlight, because I feel like that was kind of at the core of a lot of the controversy this summer around WAP and the concern about kind of how Cardi and Megan Thee Stallion were portraying themselves in this video and who can own their pleasure and who can't. And so as you kind of look at that, I mean, it's interesting how your life and these works of popular culture are intersecting in these really interesting ways. But what stood out to you in terms of that conversation based on your own experience and your scholarship?
Well, I think the conversation around WAP, like,
yeah,
the criticism it received, I think that people have forgotten the legacy of Black women creatives. And I was so happy to see a few posts of blues women. You know, so these posts are like from the 1940s and 30s of blues women with equally vulgar lyrics, equally owning their sexuality. And what Cardi B and Megan are doing is not new. You know, they're following this trajectory of women in hip hop that we could trace back to Trina, to Little Kim, to Foxy Brown, to Jackie O, right? Like we could trace it back. And so it's not nothing new under the sun. And the sad part is, like, the men never get criticized. You know, if we look at the lyrics of 3-6 Mafia and the Ying Yang Twins, and it's okay if the, you know, verbiage is towards women, but let women try to subvert and flip it, then all of a sudden it's about morals.
Yep.
But it's never about morals when it comes to men.
Well, unfortunately, we don't have a ton of time left, but I would love to end circling back to where we started at the very beginning, talking about your roots in hip hop culture and your father and how your relationship with him kind of started this relationship with the music. I'm curious about where you are with thinking about him and y'all's relationship now. I know you mentioned that he passed away some time ago, but as you have grown and evolved and kind of shifted through these various spaces of your life, where are you with kind of thinking about him and his influence on you and what you're up to now?
Yeah, at some point in time, I was doing some work around hip hop fathers to kind of show that men in hip hop, that they, or just Black men in general, are active fathers in their children's lives. I've presented at a few conferences on that research, but never actually published anything around that. I'm not sure if I would go back and revisit to publish that work, but I am proud of it. And super proud of the work that I did on kind of like examining and looking at hip hop fathers. But in short, I know that he would be proud of what I'm doing, you know.
You did have a conversation with a local rapper who was incarcerated. I think that kind of stirred up some other musings in you. Is that right?
Yeah. I had the honor of speaking with, I interviewed him for the column, Felipe Luciano, and he had served 5 years in prison. And what he's doing now is he looks at gangster rap to tell kind of like what not to do. He doesn't want to glorify it. He wants to be able to kind of warn his listeners. And so through our conversation, we kind of just unpacked like the importance of maintaining your sanity while in jail. And we also talked about, because he took some classes at UNC while in jail. And so the conversation with him, it was so fulfilling, and it reminded me of the importance of not writing people off. And he shared that, you know, him and his peers in jail, that they would exchange textbooks, that some of his friends were like, yo, let me get that psychology textbook if you're not using it. And I think sometimes society, they have this like skewed view of what somebody who's been in jail is. And they don't give that skewed view an opportunity to kind of change or morph. That conversation with him, it reminded me of my uncles. And so I have three uncles who have all changed their life around. One of my uncles, he was awarded an award from the Brooklyn Borough President for his outstanding service in the community. My other uncle, he's a deputy director. And I mean, they've all been in jail before, but they've turned their lives around where they have amazing families. They're amazing fathers. They're providing for their families. My other uncle, he served 25 years in jail, and he's been home for 5 years. And not only has he, you know, maintained a job, he's been present in his children and grandchildren's lives, and he's so smart and intelligent. And I think that that conversation with Felipe Luciano reminded me the importance for other people to not write off those who society deem are undesirable or unworthy, and that when you give somebody a second chance, the possibilities are unlimited.
Kaisha Jennings, it has been such a pleasure to talk with you. Kaisha is currently an English lecturer and faculty mentor at NC State, also a regular columnist at Indy Week and a PhD candidate at the Indiana University of Pennsylvania. You can find more about her and read some of her writing at our website, stateofthings.org. Kaisha, thank you so much.
Thank you, Anita.
That is The State of Things for today. The State of Things is produced by Amanda Magnus, Grant Hall-Mormon, Kaya Finlay, and Stacia Brown. Jenny Lawson is our technical director, and Sean Rue also helped engineer today's show. North Carolina Public Radio is a broadcast service of the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill. I'm Anita Rao.